Welcome back after a long time no see. So last week I was with our research training group, a group of PhD students at a Dachstuhl, and so as I'm head of this little PhD school, I had no choice. I had to go there, but I'm sure that Stefan did also a nice job to explain to you how to translate functional programs. And I guess, so at least he told me that he finished with this whole program, how to translate whole programs. So that would be, for example, this and some extra things like this disentanglement also. Or did he speak about that? Yes. So that is, we start now with structured data. So you may recall that so far our functional language was quite minimalistic, in that the only data type is integers, which we had. So clearly, if one has an untyped functional language, then this is fully sufficient, because perhaps some of you have heard about lambda calculus. Who has heard about lambda calculus? So this is kind of the mother of all functional languages. And it's a Turing complete something. It has no data structures at all. So you can code into functional expressions everything. And this was actually, it was one of the three formalisms which at the starting point of computer science people have considered as models of computability. So there was lambda calculus, there was mu recursive functions, and there was Turing machines. And then there was this, in the 30s, this big thing to show that all of them are equally expressive or can kind of simulate each other. So, but for us, we would not like to program in pure lambda calculus, perhaps with a few ints around, but we would like to... we are used to structured data. So what kind of structured data would we have in a functional language? So one thing which is kind of at the heart of functional programming languages, these are pairs and tuples. So that is kind of, in some sense, this is a simplification of records, in that you kind of have, or structs, in that you have, you can combine multiple data of different types into something, but you do not even give names to the components, but you access the components just by their number. So the first component of a pair. So in this sense, these tuples are, if you quickly want to combine two elements into one thing, two numbers to a point, or things like that. So that is easy if you have tuples, and it's complicated if you have structs, because you then have to come up with names. So therefore, I guess it's only lately that also imperative languages have discovered that tuples are a simple but useful thing. In functional languages, they were all around, and let's see now how to translate. So tuples can be considered as coming in two, the concept of tuples comes in two flavors. The first thing is to construct the data type, and then to destruct, that is to access the components. So that you would have for every kind of data type. And so here in that case, the constructor, there is in some sense you could consider a different constructor. So it's always opening and closing brackets, but conceptually you could think of it as different constructors for every arity. In particular, you have something like arity zero tuples. See, they're kind of opening closing brackets. So this is a particular type which is plays a role of void in imperative languages. So this is the unit type. So there's only one, so you cannot feed in any component, so there's only one value. So that's the unit type. And so then tuples with a single element kind of are considered, that is another kind of, what do you do with that? Should you distinguish that from this one? And that is kind of a difficult thing, because syntactically one would say opening and closing brackets, you can always put brackets around an expression. So therefore there are no tuples with arity 1. So this is simply the same as, here in this case, the same as the one. So that is kind of speaking aside. So that is, there. Then starting from 2, you then have real constructors producing new values. And so k equals 0 and k greater or equal than 2. These are the two things where tuples matter. So you put then as many things as you want to group together into and put it into this tuple. Now, how do you destruct? There are two possibilities. The one thing is this one. So let me first wipe the yellow stuff out. And the first thing is that one. Okay, so in a struct, you would have names for the components. And so typically what people do is, at least in the imperative and object-oriented way, you kind of write it like that. You have here the expression returning the a tuple, or the struct value, and then you kind of select. But that's kind of, and you, the selector in itself is kind, has no no standalone meaning. In functional languages, it's sometimes a little bit different. So for in ML, the road is taken to consider to instead, since there is no dot selector, but there is a selector functions. So that means for every I or J, you have the hash J, and that is a function which takes a tuple and returns the jth component. So clearly this is a... So what is problematic with this projection? Is there something problematic, or is there nothing problematic? Any idea? One must make sure... In some sense, one has to make sure that the tuple has at least j plus 1 element if one starts with component 0. So at least there should be there should be a jth component. That's the first thing. And the other thing is more conceptual, is more on the fundamental side. That is, if you have a functional language, typically modern functional languages come with a type system. And the type system kind of assigns to functions a type. So you have an argument type and a result type. Now, what would be the argument type of the hash J? So that is difficult to say, because you can apply to different tuples. But different tuples have different types. So it's not so that there's a tuple type, and the K is not part of the type. In functional languages, the K is part of the type. A tuple with 2 components is different from a tuple with 3 components. And that, in that sense, it is difficult to write down the type of this hash J. And for that, so then therefore you need some kind of hacking to get the type system right. And this type of hacking is provided in ML. So I do not tell you the solution, because this lecture is not about type systems. So here we just assume that there is some kind of way to resolve, to deal with these types, and we just translate the untyped program. So that is, therefore we have it, discuss it here, because it's not so difficult to implement. But the O'Kammel solution is this one. And here you see, this is in some sense, so what does that mean? So this E1 is assumed to be a couple of length K, and by this let thing, you kind of bind these local variables x0 to xk minus 1 with the components of the tuple. So that is the destruction. Yeah. So you kind of invert the constructor in total, not just for the jth component, but for all. And so this is clear that this can be easily typed, because type system tells you E1 will have type tuple of length 3, and then the syntax provides 3 unknowns, and you kind of match these 3 things, and then that's fine. Okay? So this is the OCaml way. It's a little bit cleaner, but that means also you have to name all the variables, which you have to mention them, although you are only interested in the first component, or in the zeroth component of the E1. And then still you have to provide the other variables. There's one way to avoid naming all these variables which you don't need, and which is what? Just a question to the experienced programmer. There's something like an anonymous variable. So you've heard of that. This is the underscore. You could write x0 or x, comma, underscore, underscore, underscore. And that means that the other components you don't care. And then it's up to the compiler what it does with that. And for example, it could invent new variables for them and never access them, or it simply never allocate these unknown variables. So that is this, using these unknown variables is a way how you can kind of do this inversion, although you're only interested in the first component. Okay? So that is for the tuples. So the first thing, when we have a data type to provide for a language, then we have to, and in functional languages, we have the kind of the invariant that all values are created in the heap, are managed in the heap, and only pointers to these values are maintained on the stack. So therefore, we have to come up with an idea how to represent tuples in the heap. Now, we could kind of come up with a new heap element, like we did for ints or for functions, or we could say, let us review what we have in the heap, and we have something which is quite similar to a tuple, namely this is our vectors. So a vector. So that since a tuple consists of say k values, we could allocate a vector of length k, and then use that as for a tuple type. So this makes it easy, because we have already an instruction like this make vector. Did we have it? No. Yes, I think we had this make vector thing. We used it for creating the global vector, for example. And that kind of instruction we reuse here to generate code for the construction of tuples. So let's see. So if we have such an expression, so this means we have to, at runtime, we have to build up a tuple value. So how do we do it? We first construct the arguments, the elements of the tuple, and then by concatenating the corresponding code, at runtime, the effect will be that we will have a sequence of references to the components on top of the stack. And then we use our fabulous instruction, make vector, to create, to wrap this list of vectors, list of references on the stack, to move it into the heap. Yeah. So this is this make vector k. So that is one thing what we should observe. Now let us now observe a little bit more. So here we see the stack distance was SD before the code for creating the tuple. And then the E0 has to be evaluated. Now it depends on what kind of programming language semantics we have. So if we have in a call by need semantics, then this we don't know whether the first component of the tuple ever will be constructed, will be looked at. So therefore we create a closure for it. And the same we do for the remaining values. And now for the remaining sub-expressions, E2 and so on, E1 and so on, the only thing which we observe is that when we create the closures for one of these expressions after the other, we have the stack distance grows because the reference is always sitting, one more reference is sitting on the stack. So therefore here we have ST plus 1 and so on. And here for the last expression we have K minus 1 references to closures sitting already on the stack. Yeah. So therefore this increase in the stack distance. Now all these expressions E0 to EK minus 1 are translated within the same address environment. So therefore always the same row, but increasing stack distance. Okay? And then when we do this one, then we create the vector and recall by that the K references on the stack will be removed from the stack and one reference instead will be added on the stack, so the stack distance then will shrink by K minus 1 as an effect of this instruction. Okay? So this was the construction of a tuple. It was, as you have seen, so it was a kind of routine matter. So it's nothing which surprises us. Ah, so one more thing which we should, there is for completeness, we should also mention that I have now explained to you that we create these closures if you have call by need semantics. If you have a call by value semantics of the whole programming language, then we never create closures. That means in these cases, all these C's here must be replaced with a V. So we will immediately evaluate these components to values and then wrap them, these values, into the vector. Okay? So that was this. Now let's proceed to the deconstruction. So accessing the jth component. So how can we do it? So in fact, so now we have the first thing is we, in order to access the jth component of E, we first have to evaluate the E to a value. And that is kind of, and the instruction sequence to do that is produced by the code V for E, row, and SD. Now we have a reference on top of the stack pointing to a vector. And we want to have the jth component, so how do we get it? Well, we have so far no possibility to access the component of a vector. We had an instruction which has a similar effect. This was this push glob. But then it was a specific vector, namely the global vector. And that was referenced by the global pointer. But here, this is a vector pointed to from the stack. So this is something else. So it's not the global vector. And so we cannot use this push glob thing. So we have to invent a new instruction. So this is this get J. And the J you see here is, although it is kind of indexing in an array, this is a value which is known at compile time. So therefore it's part of the instruction. And then we get this get J should replace the reference to the vector with the reference to the component. But this reference of this component could still be a closure. So if it's code V, then we have to generate an eval. So if you have a call by value semantics, the eval would go away anyway. Okay, so here is then the get J component, the instruction. As I said, on top of when this instruction is called, we expect a reference to a vector on top of the stack. And then, if this is the case, then this get J should first check whether this is an index out of bounds. So we should provide as our language, even if it should be, in this sense, memory safe. So we check whether this J is an admissible index. So this is, so in case our type system is very strong, we don't need this check, but to be on the safe side, we do this check. So if the J is an admissible index, and then we kind of replace the reference to the vector by a reference to the component. Yes. Okay, I was even a little bit quick. So here I did to check two things. I check whether it's really a vector, and also whether, if it is a vector, whether there's a jth component. Okay, is there a question? So that was an easy exercise. So now let us check not the deconstruction, but this inversion, where we kind of deconstruct the tuple, not just for a single component, but for all. Yeah. What happens here? But for all. So this is this thing. Now, what does that mean? So that means clearly, so if you want to generate code for it, then clearly the first thing which we have to do is we have to evaluate E1 to a value. Why to a value? Because we have to access the components. If it's a closure, then it is everything inside is unknown to we don't have the components at hand. It could be a function application or something else. So therefore, we have to create V code for the E1. So after that, we have on top of the stack a reference to a vector. Now we have to kind of create the y1 to yk minus 1. So what should these be? So these are local variables, and we kind of create them together with their values by using this get vector k instruction. This get vector k instruction, so what should that instruction do? It takes a reference to a vector and then pushes all the components on top of the stack. I think we had this get vector instruction already. We used it. Where did we use it already? No, but that get vector instruction does not put the vectors in. We didn't have it. So we had something similar when we kind of unwrapped a functional object to put the argument vector on top of the stack. But there, the argument vector was still in the functional object and not on top of the stack. So therefore, we did not have this get vector k instruction. Therefore, I provide the get vector k instruction here. So here you kind of assume that we have a reference to a vector on top of the stack, and then you kind of replace this reference with the individual references to the elements. Yeah? So that we do, so having done that, you kind of have a list of the values for the y0 to yk minus 1 on top of the stack. So the only thing now is then you where can you use the variables, the y's? You can use them in the e0. So subsequently, we have therefore to generate code for the e0. Please notice that when the code for e0 is executed, the stack distance has been increased by k, and what is this k? This k are the k components of the vector. That's fine. And now, then, the other thing is what we observe, that the e0 is not translated in the same row as e. Why? Because now k more variables have come into being and will be visible and usable in E0, and these k variables are y0 to yk minus 1. So the row prime is obtained from row by adding these variables, by introducing the y's, And now for each Y, we have to provide the relative address. So how do we get it? So, well, the relative address of the first of the Y0 is the first component. It should refer to the first component of the vector. So the first component of the vector has stack distance SD plus 1. So then this will be the relative address of the Y0. Yeah, so and so on. So that is the formula which we therefore get for the stack for the relative addresses of the y's is stack distance plus I plus 1 if I is the index of the y. Okay. Because it's not the same row as before; it's a new row, and therefore it's row dash. No, this is a function. You have to write what the... Clearly, we deduce it here. But here, we cannot pass row, because row is wrong here. So here's a new address environment, and therefore we have to say what this new address environment is. And this is the row dash, the row prime. So what was your question? It's a functional, it's a writing down code generation in a functional way. So that is kind of, we provide as a parameter the current row. And the current row for this recursive call of code V for the E0 is different from the original parameter row for the E. Okay. So that was for tuples. With tuples alone, you can do a lot of things, but you cannot do dynamic data structures because the length of the tuple is statically known. And if you want to have dynamic data structures, then so far we have no possibility to do it. The only dynamic data structure is ints, in that sense that as ints can be arbitrarily large. So that is not very satisfactory. So therefore, we at least should provide lists. So what are lists? So lists are kind of the most basic data structure in functional programming. So that is provided naturally, is built in, and there's often a dedicated support to make list handling fast. So there, some functional programmers, I have the impression, have never come beyond the status of using lists, and so for them everything is list. But that's a little bit too simple. So there are other data structures which are also useful, but lists at least should be provided. So when I say lists, then this is not a list in the sense of doubly linked list of object-oriented programming or imperative programming, but this list is actually something what one would say a list implementation of a stack. In that sense that you can put elements only on front, and you can remove them from the front. So this is stack principle. And in this sense, functional language lists are in fact stacks implemented by list nodes. So that is the story of lists. So let us see how it's syntactically, how we do deal with it syntactically. So there's one thing. There's this, if you use a minimalistic syntax, then you have at least something to denote an empty list, typically this one, opening and closing square brackets. And then you have something like a constructor, which takes an element and a list and constructs a longer list. So this cons element goes back to the very old days of Lisp programming. There they had this cons cell something that was in essence a pair of two pointers, one to the first and one to the second element, which constituted essentially the only way how to construct aggregates. So in the very early days of Lisp programming. Okay, so this is this const thing. Please note also, it's also this peculiarity that there is no agreement how this const constructor is denoted. Well, in Lisp you write const, In ML, I think you have just a single double point. Isn't it like that? No, this is in Haskell. And in OCaml, you have the double point. And I think in, what is it in ML? So I forgot it. But I think it's just, probably it's just a single double point. A single double colon. I don't know. So at least you have then, if you create your new own functional language, you have the choice of either using a single or a double, and people either use this or that. So OCaml is on the side of using a double colon as a sign of the to denote the constructor, and writes it as an infix operator, which is right associative. What does it mean to be right associative? So this means if you write 1, 2, 3, then how should the brackets be inserted? So you can write that without brackets. From the right to the left. So that means one has first this one, and then this, and then that. And this is the only way how which is meaningful also. Why? Because if you did that, then this wouldn't make sense. Why not?
Because 2 is not a list.
So this is, yes. So this is a type error. This would be a type error and rejected by the OCaml compiler or any compiler for a functional language. Okay? So therefore write associative, and clearly this 1, 2, 3 and with this lot of double colons in between, this would kind of be a little bit annoying. So what do people therefore write instead? So they have a kind of a short notation of lists. So this is with this in OCaml with this semicolon in between, and so you just list the elements and you don't list the empty list, you don't denote, write down the empty list in the end, and you just put everything into the brackets. So I just tell that this is, or remind you that this is the standard notation of lists in OCaml. It's equivalent to the other one, and so it's syntactical sugar. We will not, since we don't deal with syntactical sugar here, we may use it in examples, but we do not use it in the language. Yeah? There's one more point. Again, there is this kind of thing that there's no full agreement how the elements in a list should be separated, because how do the ML people do it? So they have comma. Yeah, and if you are uneasy or not aware about what is, if you forgot and you are not so certain with the syntax, you write that. This would also be possible in OCaml, but what would that denote? If you have comma-separated things, then OCaml assumes that this is, in fact, a tuple. So OCaml would consider it as a list with a single element, namely a tuple. So these are different things. So therefore, you must be careful where to place a comma and where to use a...
You could use a list separator, then write another tuple with commas normally? Like 1, 2, 3...
You mean whether you can write what? 1, 2, 3... 4, 5, 6... You may try it out. I'm not sure whether that how strong the bracket conventions are, whether the comma binds stronger or less strong than the colon. I'm not sure here. I never tried that. You may want to try it out. Yeah, so syntax is always kind of something to play around with. Okay, so now that was kind of the detour about the syntax of lists. So whenever you are introduced In any lecture, I guess, where people show you lists, they also show you kind of the factorial function for lists, which is the append function. So this is the most simple function, and you never can, you probably can't avoid this function when you happen to attend a functional programming course. So what is the up function? It takes two lists and appends them. So that's append. And how would one do it? So it takes two arguments. Oh, sorry. It takes two arguments. And so where is my arguments? Here. So the L and the Y. And the L is the first argument. So and how does the app function proceed? It recurses on the first argument until it gets to the empty list. Then it takes the second argument, and then it pushes on top, successively pushes on top the elements of the first list. So it would be implemented. Therefore, it would be implemented like that. Case distinction on the first argument: if it is the empty list, then please return the second argument. If it is a non-empty list, then it consists of a head and a tail. So you see here, this is, if you like, a destruction, an inversion or inversion of the constructor, yeah, of the cons. Namely, it takes a list value and splits it into the head and the tail. And the head is named H, and the tail is named T by this pattern matching. And so it need not be H and T. So these are kind of local variables which you may choose at will. So here you have now H and T naming the head and the tail, and then you can do whatever, if in this case, whatever you like to these components. So for example, you can apply the append function to the tail and Y. So this kind of creates a list which has the Y at the end and the T on front of it, and then you put H in front of it to get the overall result. So this is kind of the miracle of recursive programming, which you see here, but otherwise it's very simple. Okay, you see how it works? Is there a question? So once again, the lesson which you should learn is here that a list is in fact a stack, and that you access the components or you decompose the stack into the first element and the rest by means of a match. And here we consider a case distinction. This match introduces a case distinction on the possible values, on the possible form of values of L. And here the case distinction is empty list or non-empty list. And in general, you could consider not just two cases, but many cases. And use more complicated patterns besides these just simple ones. But if you have, so for example, you could make a case distinction between the empty list, the one element list, and any other list. Or if you like the empty list, one element, two element, three element, and so on, if you like. So you can have arbitrarily long lists where you specify specific situations by means of patterns, introduce variables for the parts of it, and then have an alternative to deal with that particular case. But here in this lecture, we take the simplistic view. We only have a case distinction on the topmost constructor of the list. So we only will consider case distinction on empty list or non-empty list, nothing else. And that's fine, because if you have more complicated pattern matching, you can kind of compile it into a list of case distinctions according to simpler forms. So that is the only thing what you really have to provide as a compiler in the back end. So in the middle end, you then might use sophisticated ways how to translate arbitrary pattern matching to this simple pattern matching. Okay? So therefore, and this makes life for us easy anyway, so therefore we will only consider that. Perhaps one more thing. So here this here in this example I had this kind of this vertical bar in front of every case, and people typically write it like that, but syntactically this one is also spurious, superfluous. You could leave it out and it would work nonetheless. So therefore in our minimalistic syntax we leave it out, and that means it still is valid or camel. So we have these two kinds of expressions to build up lists, and this expression to destruct a list. So we match an expression E0, which should be of list type, and we match it with two alternatives. The first one is the empty list with alternative E1, and the other one is the non-empty list with alternative E2. Okay? So now then the next question arises, how do we, when we want to implement lists, so again the most fundamental question is how to represent lists in list elements in the heap. So we could take the few that we kind of introduce new things, but just use again vectors. Because vectors are in some sense universal, but we would only consider here vectors of length 0 for nil and vectors of length 2 for cons. That we could do, but we take, and that would be reasonable. Here we take another view. We say we want to have additionally kind of type information in our object, so we have specific values containing the type, the name of the type, and then a list, then names of the constructors, and then afterwards the vector of the components. So that kind of seems a little bit more complicated and is a little bit more complicated, but it is in some sense more general, because by that we kind of record all the information which is required for making runtime type checking possible. And it's also, in that sense, it could be generalized if we not only have lists, but have, say, arbitrary tree algebraic data types of tree form, then we would kind of replace this tag L with some other tag, maybe T, if the type is named T. And if we do not have just two, but say 20 constructors, we then would have here 20 alternatives. And we could number the constructors of a type from 1 to 100 or so, and then use kind of, if we make this case distinction on the constructor, use hash tables, not hash tables, use kind of jump tables, kind of, to jump to the alternatives. So by that, so once again, to kind of have dedicated names of types and have a particular field for the name of the constructor, we can use kind of we can use more efficient or very efficient organization of the code to jump to the right alternative. Yeah, if we have this match thing, so that the translation of the match is similar to the translation of the switch, which we had in C. Yeah, so that would be the goal. Yeah, so that means that we kind of. And in general, it is not the case that all constructors differ only in the number of arguments, like here, so that we could use the empty vector and the vector with two components as the two encoding of the two elements of the list. We could have multiple constructors with the same arity. So therefore, we need, in general, for implementation of general types, we need the information about which constructor we have. Okay, and sorry for elaborating so much on this little stupid slide. if you have, since lists are so ubiquitous in functional programming, people use try to optimize the implementation of lists to the utmost. And that means, for example, that they store the information whether something is a list or not, sometimes even in the pointer, so that the pointer value kind of has some extra bit flags which indicate whether it is a pointer to a list, for example. And so that kind of allows to save these components completely and make handling of lists very efficient. Okay, so but here we kind of we are in the in a simple-minded and most general implementation. We do it here as we would do it for arbitrary algebraic data types. Okay, is there a question? So now, how to build lists? So the first thing is, so that means how do we translate the symbol for nil, which is a functional expression. Yeah. So for that, what should the implementation provide us with? It should provide us with a corresponding object in the heap and a reference to it on top of the stack. So we have so far no possibility to do that. Therefore, we create a new instruction to do it for us. And the same for the construction of two a list from a head and a tail. If we do this code V thing for such a list, we would first deal with the components, one in sequence after the other, and then in the end come up with this with some kind of instruction to create the corresponding list node in the heap and return a reference to it on the stack. And as we have so far no such instruction, we invent it. Perhaps one more thing which we should kind of reason a little bit about: what about the components of the list node? So if we are in a call by need environment, then we would not like to generate code to evaluate E1 or E2, because perhaps we may never access these. So therefore we create closures for these. And also please note that here when we create the second closure, then the stack distance has been increased by 1. So therefore here is stack distance plus 1, because the reference to the closure for E1 is sitting, has been pushed on top of the stacks, therefore stack distance has increased. And clear. And once again, in case we have call by value, then these closures would be, there would be no closures here. Okay, so that was easy. And we see then what the nil does. It just creates a nil element in the heap. And the cons expects two references on the stack and creates a cons cell in the heap. Okay, so that was easy. Now let us see how we kind of access the components of a list. So that is, how do we translate this match expression? So now we again, it is for us, I guess, and for you, and as for me, a routine matter how to deal with that. So we first have to kind of concentrate and recall or capture what operationally should happen here. So the first thing what should happen is, first we have to evaluate the E0, because that is where we do the pattern matching on. And then we kind of, once we have evaluated that to a value, then we have, okay, then it should be a list, otherwise we cannot destruct it. So if we have a well-typed language, we are sure that it will be a list. So there is this checking whether the value is a list is kind of can be abundant. But then the next thing is, we have to kind of look what kind of list element it is. So, and if it is an empty list, then we have to proceed with the E1, and otherwise we have to proceed with E2. So if it is nil, then do this. Else, do something else. This looks like an if then else. So in this sense, it's as it is an alternative of two things, we would implement it similarly to an if then else. What is the only difference to an if then else? Or the kind of so clearly there's one so that we have kind of references and not booleans on top of the stack. So that makes it so we have to kind of compare something some object in the heap with constructors. So that is okay. We could kind of do an get basic thing, get list thing, and to get that the name of the constructor on top of the stack to inspect it. So that we could do if we like. So in that sense, this would kind of still not make a big difference. So the difference, kind of to make the long story short, is that here we, that in the else part, it's not just that we jump to the E2, but we also have some more variables. We have to introduce the, we have to access the components of the list. So these are kind of, this is kind of the substantial distinction to an if then else. Otherwise, we would proceed similarly to if then else. So therefore, the code looks, at least as I dreamt it up, I suggest to let it look like that. So we first evaluate not the condition, but the main expression, the E0, we evaluate it, then we have on top of the stack this reference. So these operations of kind of accessing the name of the constructor and comparing it with nil on or cons, that kind of, we could kind of detail it by introducing such corresponding micro instructions, if you like, but I kind of refrained from that and instead preferred to have more powerful instructions like this T list. Why? This is the same story which we had several times. To have powerful virtual machine instructions allows the implementer of the virtual machine to invest, to use all kinds of what he likes, to as low-level code as he likes to implement that complicated operation. And so this gives a better performance as if we detailed it all in virtual machines, which is slow to interpret. Yeah. So therefore, this T list A here, and this T list will check whether it is null, nil. If it is nil, it will proceed with that code, and if it is non-nil, it will proceed here. So let us first ignore that and consider the nil case. So once we did the nil case, so this is the E1, the code for the E1, where will we proceed? Well, then we are done with the match expression, and we proceed afterwards. That is, we jump to the B. Now, what happens? What happens now in case that we found a constructor? Then we have to, that is the case starting at label A. Then we have to evaluate the generate code for the E2. So that's fine, and have to execute it. But please observe that for the E2, the address environment again has changed. Why? Because now the H and the T, the variables introduced for head and tail of the list, have been added to the set of local variables. They have been pushed on top of the stack, and they have pushed on top of the stack at the positions SD plus 1 and SD plus 2. So that we have to, at least we have to add to the address environment which is with respect to which we generate code for the E2. And we also note that the stack distance has increased by 2. Before, the code for E2 is executed, and therefore we have to take this information into account when generating code for E2. Okay. So that's kind of the general idea. Now let us still look how we have. I still have not yet revealed how this T-list A instruction works. Ah, so perhaps one more thing I have forgotten in the. So after we have done the E2, we have to slide by 2. Why? We have to insert this slide 2 instruction. Why? Please speak up a little bit. Speak louder. This is true. So this slide 2 will remove the two local variables which have been introduced by the T-list again removes them from the stack again, because now at the end of the match they go out of scope. They are no longer available, so therefore they must be squeezed out of the stack. This is done by this slide 2. Perfect. And then again also in this case we proceed with the code starting at position B. Okay, so here the T-list. So what does it do? So the first thing is it checks whether it is in. So here I make it for an untyped environment also. That means if it checks whether on top of the stack we have a list, and if it's not a list, then we kind of have an error and quit. And otherwise, it checks whether there's a nil thing, and if there is a nil thing, then it kind of proceeds. It does nothing. So this is like the if the condition is met, then in the if then else, the code simply proceeds. So nothing happens then. So the stack is simply popped, and computation proceeds. Otherwise. That means, in this case, we found the cons, and then we jump to the PC, location A, code location A, to label A, and before that, we kind of take the two pointers to the components of the list and push them on top of the stack. Yeah, so we introduce these two local variables, H and T, and then we jump to A. Okay? Clearly, that's it. And now we can kind of look at the code generation would result for the app function. So the app function is a recursive function, so one would do a let rec and introduce the A, and then for A is a functional object would be created and put into this functional object would then override the dummy in the recursive introduced by the recursive definition. But then inside this functional object there would be the code for the body of app. And the code for this body of app is translated in an address environment which gives a binding to the global variable occurring in the body of the app. What is the global variable occurring in the body of app? So let me just go back. So here. So now that is the body of app. What is the global variable in here? So you see it immediately. It is this one. The name of the recursive function. Because the definition of up is this function. It has the local variables L and Y. And the H and T are all introduced locally inside the definition of up. So that is this right-hand side in the definition of up has only one global variable, which is the name of the recursive function itself. So this is sitting in the global vector for which we translate the body of this function. Yeah, and then we translate this function definition, and then if we kind of proceed for the body of that function, then we would have to translate this one, this match expression, and inside that, again, we have then the L and the Y are parameters. They are sitting on the stack, and the up is in the global vector. So therefore, when we translate this, now the body of the function up, it has actually, so one would have this up, yeah, and then there is this L. We additionally have L and Y. L has relative address, this is local, and zero, and the Y is mapped, this is a local variable, and minus one. Yeah? So these are, this is the address environment in which we now translate the body of the function on the right-hand side of the recursive definition of up. Okay? So now that since this up function is a two argument function, so therefore we have a test arg 2 at the beginning and a return 2 at the end. And then the first thing is we have to evaluate the body of function is this, then this is this match expression. We first have to match for the value of L. Yeah? So that is, we have so now the stack distance is zero after the test arc 2. The stack distance is zero. And so now how do we push L? Stack distance minus relative address. So zero minus zero is zero. Therefore, this one pushes the reference to L. We evaluate it. Now we have the value of L on top of the reference, so the value of L on top of the stack. And then comes our favorite new instruction, test list. And then following the test list comes the code for the nil case. So this means when L is nil. In that case, we want to return the value of Y. So how do we do it? So we kind of, as the stack distance has decreased by one. Why? Because the reference to the L has been popped away. So therefore the stack distance by the test list. So therefore stack distance is zero again. Then we have to push the value of Y. Now zero minus minus one is one. Therefore push log one pushes us the value of Y. We evaluate it, and then we have the value of Y, and that is what, and then we are done with the with this nil case, and therefore we jump to the end of the whole match expression, which is at location B, where we kind of return from the body. Okay, so that was kind of the idea. So now let us kind of remove this one, and now we are in the cons case. In the cons case, this is starting at address A. There we have kind of stack distance 2. Why? Because it's the head and tail which have been pushed on top of the stack. And there then we have to create to head, cons, and then the recursive call to the up function. So how do we access the head? So the head is has stack distance. So what is the, we can write down now what is the head? Sorry. What is the head? The head is mapped to stack distance is to a local variable 1, and tail has a relative address 2. Therefore, if we kind of now here at when we want to push a reference, the reference corresponding to age, we have to make a push log with 2 minus 1. Yeah, stack distance minus relative address gives 1. So therefore, this one here pushes the value of age on top of the stack. Now we then, at the second thing, we now have to kind of get the value, either the value or the closure for the new tail, and that is the recursive call of up for tail and y. And so if we are in a call by need environment, we would construct the closure for that. So the closure would first push all the variables which occur inside this up, tail, and y. So this is up, tail, and y. These are three things. So now for the up, this is this push glob 0. This pushes the reference to up. Then how do we access the tail? So the tail has relative address 2 and is local. So currently we have a stack distance 4. 4 minus 2 is 2. So therefore, this one would kind of push the T. And then we have to access finally the Y. The Y has stack distance minus 1, has relative address minus 1. So 5 minus 1 is 6. So therefore, this one gives us the Y. So you see, you have to really to know the address environment, otherwise you are completely doomed and will not be able to generate code or to understand what these stupid numbers 6, 2, and so on mean. Yeah? Okay, so now we have the components of the closure, the global the elements for the global vector of the closure. We have them on top of the stack. Then we kind of make the vector, produce the global vector for the closure, and here we create the closure. And here I said I made a disentanglement, so the code to evaluate the closure, I put it here. So this is here. No, including this one. So this is the code for evaluating the closure. And then what is executed, which is wrapped into the closure. So that is referred to by the C. So this is the code which is executed when eval is made to the closure. So given the closure, then we kind of proceed here with we have now the closure for the tail. The head is below that. We now can do, can make the construction. And that means it takes the two things which are on top of the stack and wraps them into a cons object and puts them in the heap and returns a reference to it. Therefore, the stack distance decreases by 1. So therefore, stack distance is 2. And then comes the slide to squeeze out the two auxiliary variables for the head and for the head and the tail of the list, and then slides down the reference to the cons to the two memory cells down in the stack. Therefore, now stack distance is 1, and we return. So that's a little bit. I hope you could follow. That is kind of the story. What is really going on when when this is executed, and we may also look at this green thing. Now, what would that do? So the green thing is the part which is done when somebody asks for the value of the recursive call of the app. So how would one do that? So there, one first has to push the arguments of the app from right to left. So the first thing, the rightmost is the Y, which is this push glob 2, and then comes the T, which is the push glob 1, and then comes the up, which is the push glob 0. So now then, and then we can, this all these could be closures, So therefore, we have to do the eval in order to evaluate the up. So at least the function is known. The value of the function should be a reference to a functional object should be on top of the stack. So therefore, this eval here. And then comes the apply. And so the apply will then ultimately evaluate this recursive call. And then we have the value on top of the stack for the recursive call. And we then do the, then for the closure code, recall that there always was in the end this update to replace the closure with the value. Okay, so but that's so that's the whole story. In the end, maybe I kind of remove all that. You see here an instance of this test list thing, which separates the evaluation of the V code for the expression on which to evaluate with the between that and this label A, which is referenced here. So in that area, you find the case for the until I should make it in this way. So the T list until to the jump B. So this kind of is the on the decoration of the code for the nil, and starting from A until the slide 2, which is here. Until the slide 2, you find the code for the constructor case. So that ends again. If you like, so the macros, the control flow structure can easily recover from these from by looking out for these special instructions, but the details in there again you have it's not so easy to recover the functional program from the generated code again due to these weird address calculations. Is there a question? And once again, so that is that this kind of the code for this list deconstruction looked very much like if then else, because the list has two constructors. If you have 20 constructors, you would like to do this to start with this one, evaluating the expression where you do the case distinction on, and then try to construct a switch table. And use the constructor, the name of the constructor, or the index of the constructor to select the alternative. You would not use it, do it like that, the if-then-else. And if you think of that you statically can enumerate the constructors, you will have the simple case of a switch statement which you can use. So a simple case is where you can always let the alternative start with zero, and there are no holes in between, and there is no possibility that you get another constructor which is outside the fixed range. So you have this, you recall there was this complicated hacking of dealing with all these special cases. This is not necessary when you when you try to translate case distinction for constructor deconstruction. Okay. Now that was the V code for these things, for these data structure elements. It remains perhaps to check what we do with the C code. So the C code, we had a general scheme. That is, we always construct a closure and put the code, the V code, inside. That was our kind of default implementation for the C code. But also recall that in several cases we were able to significantly improve on that to avoid unnecessary closures. And so, for example, we would never construct a closure which inside contains just a basic value, namely an empty list. So for an empty list, the C code would be the same as the V code, and that would simply mean we directly create the nil. Yeah? Because why should we put a closure around creating nil. So the closure is bigger than the nil inside. So therefore, we would not do it. Now it's more. So now a different story is when we have kind of when we create should create a closure for a list. So we could kind of take the point of view that we would that there we cannot we don't know whether we will access the whether we will access anything of that, and we could kind of I suggest still that one would try to push the closures kind of down. So that means one at least constructs the topmost element of the list, but creates closures only for the components. Or codes, at least call C code only for the components. And this would have the nice effect if you apply the construct, this cons operator to two variables. For variables, we had the optimization that we would not create closures, then we wouldn't create no closures at all. So therefore, this is a good idea to, by pushing closures down in the expressions a little bit, hoping that they might disappear completely and we would not have to create closures at all. And the same kind of pushing down closures from the topmost level, one level down, could be done here. So here we also would kind of push the closures down one level. That has the disadvantage that we would not only have to create one closure, but multiple closures, but hopefully these closures are for smaller expressions and would go away completely because there's were variables. And there's also the possibility here in this case what one would have to create multiple closures here, multiple closures all, and one could think of that if these expressions E0 to EK minus 1 contain multiple, that we reuse the global vector. We use one global vector for all of them, and that allows us to kind of and this wrapping up the global vectors for different expressions and wrapping up the same global vector for multiple expressions, this is what makes this closure construction of closures so expensive. But if we could reuse here the same global vector for all of these expressions, creating these closures would be more or less with little cost only. Okay, so again here the idea, we push the construction of closures down one level, hoping that perhaps due to this, that there are functions and we need no closures, there are constants, we need no closures, or variables and we need no closures. Then, and so that by that, perhaps by postponing it, making this closure construction lazily, if you like, we might omit some of the closures completely. Okay, so that was kind of a little optimization or hacking how you could kind of proceed with doing as little closure construction as possible. Then here comes, this is one optimization which one could do. Now comes kind of the optimization which is provided by all compilers for functional programs. And without that, kind of functional programming would be much, much less practical as it is. And that is a special treatment of last calls. So the idea here is, the deficiency, if you like, of functional programming essentially is that the only way of, that you have no loops. You have only recursion, so everything must be realized by means of recursion. So recursion is strong enough to do it, but there's one big advantage of a loop, and that is it doesn't consume memory. You can in the same memory you can iterate over the data, and you iterate until you are finished. But in functional programming, for every new loop iteration, you have to create a new stack frame, because it's a recursive call. And that means only in the very end, when you are done with the loop, you can kind of give up all the memory for all the iterations. And that is a little bit, and this is awkward, because think, for example, that you want to implement a reactive system which is running forever. You can do that in an imperative language because you have these loops. And a program which like an operating system which runs forever should not allocate more and more and more stack space, because otherwise it runs out of memory. You get the machine crashes, and that is an undesirable effect. So we would like to allow the programmer to use these constant space iterations. And that is in fact possible by means of this last call optimization. So what is the last call? The last call is is something very simple. You have a big expression which computes a value. Now it could be that the value returned for this big expression could be computed at a sub-expression. And then if this is a function call, then this would be a last call of this expression. So you might wonder, so this is the kind of more or less formal definition, but let us look at examples, and then it becomes immediately clear. So look at this expression, for example. So what would you notice? So there is that is kind of the body of that is a body of a particular form to implement the reverse of a list. This is perhaps the second frequent function which is shown in courses on functional programming. But let us just from a syntactical point look at this expression. So what happens here? So you have a match, then you have one alternative. Okay, so that is if X is the empty list, then you return another parameter, here Y. Okay, so there is no call here, so there is also no last call. But assume that it happens that the X is not the empty list, but a non-empty list. So then we are in this alternative. And then the returned value is that provided by this call. So it is not necessarily the case that program execution ever will reach that point. But once it reaches this point, then you are sure that this value here returns the value of the whole expression. And in fact, this is the body of another function. So here we have a recursive call, which once it may not be ever evaluated, but if it is evaluated, then once control reaches this point, you know the value which is computed here is the value of the overall function. Yeah? So this is not always the case. This is not the case for every recursive call in a function. So recall the factorial function. So the factorial function, so the body of it had this if then else, and then there was here syntactically at the very end is the recursive call. But this call is not a last call. Why not? Also, it is syntactically at the very end. Why it is not the last call?
Because we often need to multiply the whole X's.
Yes, because this value is not the value for the factorial function in this particular when X is greater than 1. You first have to multiply. You afterwards have to still to multiply it with X. And only then the value of this expression is returned. Yeah. So you see the clear distinction. Once you are at this position, you can forget about the match and everything. This value is the value you are interested in. But while in the lower case, this is not the case. Once you have arrived at the call F applied to X minus 1, you are not yet done. You still have to multiply with X. Okay, so this makes the difference. And now what is the overall fantastic idea which people had? I don't know. Probably this also goes back to the old days of Lisp programming. It's a very simple idea, but it is tremendously successful. And that is when you have arrived here. So that is, you are in a big, you have this function R. You arrive at this red last call. Then you can give up everything in the all local variables because these are no longer required for returning the result, because you know this last call will return the result. So you can give up the whole stack frame of the caller and just do this recursive call. Now giving up the, so, or you could make it in a different way. You do not give up the recursive call of the stack frame of the caller and just do this last call, but instead reuse the stack frame of the caller. Squeeze out the locals of the caller, but leave the stack frame, all the organizational cells, and then kind of start and then execute within this already existing stack frame the new this last call. And by that kind of, in essence, that means that you kind of that the stack is not growing anymore with this recursive call. If all the recursive calls are last calls, then the stack will never increase, but you always sit within the same stack frame and do your computation. And by that, you end up in something which is similar to a loop. Okay, so that is kind of the key idea. And that, so here is... So therefore, you have a function body, and within this function, so the function, let us say it is function f, and so this is it has a function body, and it has k arguments. Yeah, and then you have inside this function body you have this last call, so this is an application, function application expression, so let us call that L. And now what would we do? So we kind of, when we arrive at this last call L, which we have syntactically identified beforehand, and that's the nice thing, you can syntactically identify it. You don't need semantic analysis of complicated form, it's a very syntactical thing. And then, perhaps one more thing, because time is almost over. One more thing, this last call optimization you could also do in Java, for example. So people don't, it's not, because recursion is not so popular with Java programmers, so therefore this last call optimization would apply to virtually the empty set of Java programs. But in principle, you could do it there as well as here. You cannot do it for C for interesting reasons, but you could do it for Java. Okay, so now what would we do? So the first thing is we have to prepare for the evaluation of this last call L. This means we have to deal with the arguments E0 to EM minus 1 of this last call, and also evaluate this function E prime to a functional value. So that is kind of what we have, the new parameters and the new function that we have to provide anyway. And then, but before we do the apply, we squeeze out the locals which have been consumed, and also the formals which have been, the actual parameters of F which have been consumed. If F has k arguments, these have been, once you arrive at the last call, these are eaten up, you can move them out. So that is, if M is the locals plus k, locals is the stack distance, plus k, these are the parameters, these you can squeeze out of the stack. This is done by this move instruction, and only then you do the apply. And notice, before this last call, here at this case, at that particular point, before evaluating the parameters, we do not introduce a new stack frame. So there is no mark instruction here. It's just we do this, we do the parameters, we do the function, we squeeze out the locals and the consumed parameters of the caller, and then we call apply. That's it. And we see And an example tomorrow. Tomorrow we have again lecture at 10:15, like today. Thank you for your attention.